population of Dodge City passed an $85 million school bond to support the heavily Hispanic population schools in June of 2015 with 58% approval. For the high school, this means a new academic wing and expansion to some career technical centers, the performing arts space, and the physical education facilities. Keeping a school coherent through such dynamic changes is challenging. Each August, some 20 or 30 new immigrant students are likely to show up. They continue to dribble in through May. The latest wave came from Guatemala, many of whom, even at the high school level, were entering a classroom for the first time and were illiterate. At home, conditions are often poor, and many families arrive with a rough history. Creating a safe and positive place for these students is important to the school system and to the city overall. That's because Dodge City is no longer a stop on the road for most migrant families. Think of Ernestor. The work opportunities, primarily at the meatpacking plants, are year-round and pay a wage that most workers consider solid. The families are in Dodge to stay. Many of the children of Dodge City immigrants, unlike their parents, know only this way of life. The school administrators told me that their students today don't see color, which speaks to the mature integration of races within Dodge City. One sign of this particularly struck me. While kids often tend to hang out with their own ethnicity or race, the norm I saw at Dodge City school halls, at the public library, and at the public swimming pool was groups of kids all jumbled up. However they were sorting themselves out, it didn't look to be on the basis of ethnicity or race. I dutifully asked Feist about the usual problems in American schools, drugs, alcohol, bullying, and the like. "We have them all," she said. Any other answer would have been suspect, of course. A look through the school's website or newsletters confirms those problems and many more do exist and are aggressively addressed. Among the social services I saw, counseling for students who are pregnant, who are already moms, who have incarcerated parents. Resources for everything from suicide prevention to intervention in self-cutting and alcohol abuse. There were also reminders that drug-sniffing dogs would occasionally be present. About 400 students in Dodge City are designated as a special subset of minority, migrants. According to the federal definition, being a migrant child means you have been in the current school district for no more than 3 years, and you are a child of a parent working in agriculture or fishing. Migrants are the newcomers. In Dodge City, employment mainly means working the line at National Beef or Cargill in jobs that stop short of actual packaging of the product. No office workers, no administrative jobs. Hands-on with raw product, says Robert Vinton in his no-frills language. During a visit I paid him on a very hot July morning, Vinton described how the migrant population of Dodge City has changed over the years. He gathered several of his staff, all women, in the spacious but modest office in the old Dodge City Community College building. Here are some of the points they raised in building a profile of Dodge City migrants. Arrivals. The children are arriving at older ages than they were 30 years ago. Many are already in their teens. Some children come with families, others don't. There are many monikers that describe children's varying status. Some border children are smuggled in alone or with an older companion. Some are designated as emancipated youth, having no parents responsible for them. Others are the migrant out-of-school youth, those up to age 22 who are working but who do not yet have a high school diploma. A sizable number of new migrants are designated as SLIFE kids. SLIFE is an unfortunate acronym that everyone struggles to deconstruct. It stands for Students with Limited or Interrupted Formal Education. They are the teenagers who have rarely or never been to school before. Vinton occasionally referred to the migrant children as kiddos, This was the second time I had heard this term used by a Dodge City education administrator. Mike Martinez had also used the word. Kiddo is a familiar term of endearment to my Midwestern ears, and it struck me as a more humane way to refer to the children than border children or emancipated youths or migrants. Language. Most of the migrants speak Spanish. More than 50% of the students, not all of the migrants, in the DCPS are enrolled in well-established English language learner, ELL, programs. The recently arrived Guatemalans have brought a new linguistic twist. While Guatemala is officially a Spanish-speaking country, roughly 24 indigenous languages are spoken there as well. For some who arrive in Dodge City, an indigenous language is their sole language. This forces the same kind of telephone game translation system I saw applied in Sioux Falls, where a series of interpreters hot potato a conversation from English to two or three other languages and back again. The children learn English quickly, of course. I watched a conversation at the checkout desk of the Dodge City Public Library play out one day as the English-speaking librarian talked to a young Spanish-speaking father about his overdue books. He needed to return the books or pay a fine before he could check out more, she tried to make him understand. He looked hopelessly puzzled until his very young daughter was finally summoned from the children's section to serve as a translator. Academics. The schools are balancing multiple pressures. They must meet their traditional goal for high school graduation rates, provide a realistic career path for many students toward trades like welding or mechanics, teach some students to be basically functional in English, and address the extreme challenges from some entering migrant students. In Dodge City, there are some illiterate teenage children arriving who don't know how to hold a pencil, Vinton told me. Culture. Much of what we know in our bones arrives out of left field to new immigrants or refugees. How do you explain to those who have fled from desperate circumstances via a difficult journey and survived by keeping their heads down that it is all right to seek advocacy or to complain if someone, a landlord for instance, seems to be taking advantage of you? How do you establish a foundation of trust to convince a migrant that legal rights allow you to speak up and that it won't stir up trouble for you, especially in a newly politically charged era? Support systems in Dodge City involve not only the schools, but also dozens of additional city and civic groups, ranging from the Salvation Army to the dental clinic, to the emergency shelter, the health clinic, churches, and the credit union. Other centers help with testing, placement, community information, referrals to other agencies that can help with even more pieces of life. Dodge City's public library, a foundational block in the support system, is called a Family Place Library. It offers all sorts of resources, workshops, and connections for parents and caregivers who are learning to raise young children, immigrant or not. There were scads of kids in the library each time I visited. They were searching for books, working on their summer reading programs, playing in the early childhood area, coloring and drawing. One day, I stopped by the big multi-use space in the lower level, where at least 250 kids, with adults in tow, had come for a demo and program with a traveling group from the Wichita Exploration Place. A few middle schoolers working at the library that summer were helping the kids run around obstacle courses, climb through tunnels, and try archery. I asked one of the young volunteers where she would be, if not the library, on that hot day. Probably at the pool. One staffer in Vinton's migrant education office described her home visits to families. She would, for example, arrive bearing shrink-wrapped packets of age-appropriate books for the half a dozen young children in a single family, calling each by name and handing them what she said are most likely the first books they have ever owned in their lives. A staffer described the meal one family was eating when she arrived. Cereal with water. I recalled this detail When I watched the 1960 Edward R. Murrow mindset-shifting TV documentary, Harvest of Shame, about poverty among migrant workers. A migrant woman identified as Mrs. Dobie, the mother of 9 children, described a typical family dinner. "Well, I cook a pot of beans and fry some potatoes, some corn or something like that. We don't have milk except when we draw a paycheck. We have milk maybe once a week." Teaching nutrition is also something the migrant education program tries to do today. We were lucky enough to be in Dodge City on a so-called Final Friday evening for the monthly visual, culinary, and performing arts community walk around town. It kicked off at the Carnegie Center for the Arts, which is housed in the original Carnegie Library building. That Friday's demonstrations featured Wanda Adamson, a quilter from the 850-strong nearby town of Jetmore. People milled about, then drifted down to the next venue, the Second Avenue Art Guild, to sample wine and cheese among the works of local artists. We talked with Jake Hendricks, a young millennial who was part of a large family of artists showing their creations that night. Jake still worked on the family farm and was also launching a startup with his brother Rob, the Hendricks Keg Company, to make mini beer kegs powered by carbon dioxide cartridges. We also met John and Connie Chavez. He's a saxophone player with the Dodge City Cowboy Band, a community band since 1879 that still performs for the town each week during the summer. Later that week, on the 4th of July, we joined much of Dodge and its tourists under a tent in front of the Long Branch Saloon, where actors in period regalia stage surprisingly alarming shootouts by day. That evening, Chavez and the cowboy band performed with a troupe of Hispanic and Anglo high-kicking can-can dancers. Like so many small towns in America, Dodge City goes all out with parades, barbecues, and spectacular celebrations. Afterward, we counted at least half a dozen firework displays along the flat horizons in Dodge, all visible from our third-story hotel room next to the casino on the edge of town. Our final stop that evening was the old Dodge City Railway Depot, a Richardsonian Romanesque building erected in 1896, during the bustling rail days when the Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe Railway stopped in Dodge City to move buffalo and later longhorn cattle from Texas. Today, Dodge City is an Amtrak stop for the Southwest Chief, which comes through town a few times a day. Mark Viertaler, the new marketing director of the startup Boot Hill Distillery, was, with a flourish, pouring his signature drink, the Playa, a concoction he makes from light rum, lavender syrup, and elderflower liqueur. That evening, we walked much of Second Avenue to where the buildings turned over from earlier merchants, including the Warshaws, into bars, nail salons, or photographers' shops. Some shops sell clothing with a Western flair, and others offer quinceañera dresses for rent to 15-year-olds for their gala celebrations. Large murals of Western scenes are painted on the broad sides of a multi-story building. The old Dodge City Daily Globe building remains as today's office. Roger Bloom, a heavyset man in his late 40s with a shaved head, had worked at small newspapers around the country, Nebraska, Pennsylvania, Missouri, elsewhere, before coming to Dodge City as the Globe's managing editor. He volunteered that he was a recovering alcoholic who had been sober for 25 years. He drank coffee continuously from a mug the size of a beer growler while we met with him. "This has been a city that has absorbed outsiders from the beginning," he said about the response to immigrants and refugees. "It makes it go more smoothly now." Downtown Dodge City has some way to go before it rivals everyone's favorite model downtown of Greenville. But it has potential and what lots of people would call good bones. 2 new establishments are coming to town. A microbrewery called Dodge City Brewing Company will be built on the empty lot on 3rd Avenue, and it will be a welcome rival to the highway row of fast food stops for hungry tourists, KFC, McDonald's, Arby's, Burger King, Subway, Sonic, Taco Bell, and Applebee's, which has the most strategic location right outside the Information Center and the Boot Hill Museum and reconstructed Williamsburg-like shops. The Boot Hill Distillery has undertaken an ambitious renovation of the former municipal building that is nearly finished. We took a tour of the gleaming distilling room and tasted a few of the spirits at the restored long bar. Garden City and Spurville, Kansas. We took a few field trips outside Dodge, the first heading east about 17 miles to the town of Spurville, population 800, deep in corn and wheat country. Prosperity has come to Spurville recently, with the growth of wind-produced electricity, which has more than doubled in the last 5 years in the United States. Out here, Mayor Kevin Heek told us, anything under a 20-mile-an-hour wind is a breeze. Capitalizing on that natural asset, farmers have let energy companies plant rows of giant space-age-like turbine towers in their fields. With a 200-plus-foot tower, topped by a 100-plus-foot blade, and sweeping nearly an acre of airspace, the windmills have changed the landscape of the town. Mayor Heek described the farmers and town's reaction. People could see a way of generating income. The towers don't take up that much space. They farm right around them. It just goes with the city of Spurville. Farmers' incomes have as much as doubled. The city has benefited as well. We drove past new playgrounds, a new school, and other signs of economic health that the wind energy has brought to Spurville. Another day, we drove west from Dodge City toward its neighbor Garden City. Dodge City, Garden City, and Liberal composed the so-called beef triangle of Kansas. Dodge envies Garden its big box stores. Garden envies Dodge its impressive development in buildings, like the arena, the Boot Hill Casino, the Long Branch Lagoon Water Park, the raceway, and the classy athletic fields. Neither seems to envy Liberal. As we headed to Garden City, about 50 miles west of Dodge, we passed farms, feedlots, and a wind turbine blade distribution center. On US 50, we routinely slowed behind trucks hauling cattle or harvested wheat. Also, small convoys trailed the transporter of a single 120-foot wind turbine blade like a presidential motorcade. When one of those trucks gets to an intersection, traffic stops in all directions as it navigates the turn. We were meeting up with Sister Rosarita Weber and Sister Janice Thome, nuns of the Dominican Order of Peace who serve the poor in Garden City, to accompany them on their delivery rounds from the town's food pantry. The two sisters were sympathetic, but no nonsense. They dealt with tough cases daily, as they taught folks to drive or helped them negotiate medical bills, or drove families the 7-hour round trip to Wichita for services found only in the big city. They lived modestly in a mid-century split level in the center of town, a place comfortable yet basic. A large statue of the Blessed Virgin Mary presided from a pedestal in a corner of the dining room. The food pantry was set up in a small warehouse. We waited our turn to sign in and assemble our shares to distribute. A line of others waited behind us, showing the documentation entitling them to the free food. I was expecting fresh foods similar to those in Ajo's food bank, which included at least some potatoes, broccoli, and citrus. But in the absence of a thriving local garden-to-table food movement like Ajo's, Garden City's donated goods came from some of their big box stores or chains. A typical delivery that day included a few frozen entrees, bags of rolls, a pizza, a pair or two of brightly colored socks, a pack of cookies, and maybe a roll of frozen venison, although Sister Janice worried that none of her recipients, all Hispanic, would be familiar with venison or how to cook it. One lucky family would receive a frozen chicken. Garden City, like Dodge and Liberal, is now a majority-minority city. Its population is already mostly Hispanic, estimates range from 50% to 60%, and trending upward as new employees find better-than-minimum-wage yet very difficult jobs at the meatpacking plants. Sister Rosarita and Jim went in one direction, and Sister Janice and I started in the other. Sister Janice asked me if I needed the air conditioner on in the car. It was clear to me that the right answer would be no, since the AC would consume more fuel. If Sister Janice could take it, so could I. We each delivered to 5 or 6 families. Those whose plans for a new life built around the meatpacking plants had slipped off the rails. Sister Janice and I started at the bungalow of a woman named Hilda. Her house was meticulously kept, with heavy wooden furniture, photos, and decor clearly from Mexico. In 1989, she had been badly injured in a car accident which killed her only son and left her able to take care of herself and her housekeeping, but little more. Her husband had recently taken up with another woman, leaving debts on his way out. Hilda fell between the financial cracks, receiving a monthly settlement from her accident that was too little to allow her to do more than scrape by, and too much to let her qualify for other benefits or move forward with her life. I asked if I could take a few photos, and she asked me back immediately and rhetorically if I would like to see her bedroom. She posed proudly next to the bed, her pièce de résistance, with its ornately carved heavy wooden headboard and an opulent red and gold damask medallion bedspread. Sister Janice and I drove on to another Hispanic family with a single mother. At the door of the small dark house, the kind where you feel the floorboards give a little beneath you from the lack of a solid foundation, the dim interior not quite cool against the summer heat, we met the teenage daughter, who cared for her epileptic brother while her mom was at work, and she chatted with us about her summer. She said she wasn't doing much except reading. Right now, she said, she was reading a book called Bad Boy Next Door. I later saw online that there were 2 books with that title, and a third more emphatically named So Bad, Bad Boy Next Door. She declined the venison we offered, as she didn't know how to cook it. As we raced through the next stops, which were all trailers, everything began to blur. Here are 2 families' stories in short. A woman from Guatemala fled with her husband from the guerrilla fighters. They gained temporary political asylum in the United States. The husband lost his status and was repatriated. The woman moved quickly with her children when neighbors told her the INS was also looking for her. She has a number of kids, 5 or 6, I wasn't sure, and for a while, she raised some chickens and earned $100 a week by babysitting. Then she became sick. She started bleeding, the source of which turned out to be a tumor. No one was home when we stopped by, so we left the box on the steps to the trailer door, piling the frozen items together and hoping some family member would arrive home soon before everything thawed. Another Hispanic woman lived in a small, neat trailer with flowers and a carefully groomed bit of outdoor landscaping. She said she had been serially beaten by her husband, who then started in on their 8-year-old daughter. One day, after the husband inadvertently left the family's only cell phone behind, the woman managed to call the police. They arrived, but so did the husband, who persuaded his wife not to press charges. He has since left her alone, but without a chance for winning a non-immigrant U visa for those who have suffered substantial physical or mental abuse. Since she disqualified herself by not pressing charges. Catch 22. With hopes of a path to moving on, she's working on a U visa for her daughter, also abused, but who, as a minor, can apply for the visa. If that works, the daughter might be able to piggyback her mother along as sole guardian of a minor. There were many complicated stories in Garden City. Sister Janice's cell phone continued to ring during our rounds. People were asking her for all manner of help, like gas money to get to Dodge City, or answers for questions on a job application. Sister Janice says she gets 20 or 30 calls a week, and considerably more at the point in the month when utilities get disconnected. We went on to another trailer park. This one was more dismal, since it had been abandoned by many occupants who numbered among the 2,300 workers who lost their jobs after a fire at the Conagra Beef Company on Christmas night of 2000. Some vacant trailers were covered with graffiti, their windows shattered. Sister Janice told me that initiation rites from gangs included this kind of daring do that ruined the property. The stories from the families who remained in this park were entwined and twisted, more and less hopeful. As I tried to absorb the plights and probable destinies for families like these, the indefatigable Sister Janice dropped me off at her house while she pressed on to transport a family from a school's summer free lunch program to their trailer. By then, I had only one recurring cliched thought. They are all one accident or illness away from total disaster.
Erie, Pennsylvania. From Gaithersburg, our hometown airport just outside D.C., the flight to Erie is just over 90 minutes. If you're heading north from Washington, a shift in phase usually comes around the time you cross the Susquehanna River and the border with Pennsylvania. Maryland is already rural by this point. Farms and forests if you're headed eastward towards Philadelphia, or the hills and low mountains that become the Appalachians if you head west to north. We passed over the long, wave-like ridges that carried the veins that made this Pennsylvania's coal country near Johnstown and Altoona. From above, the ridges have an almost man-made, planned quality to their look, evenly spaced and symmetrical compared with the surprises and chaos of other hills. Then, as we left the mountains behind us and crossed over the flatter, forested land of the northwest corner of the state, we caught a glimpse of Lake Erie from nearly 50 miles away. To Deb, this sight meant coming home because of her childhood along the lake. For me, it involved looking for our destination of Erie and beginning to pick it out by the most distinctive part of its geography, the Presque Isle Peninsula, which sweeps out like a 6-mile-long comma from the city into the lake. In the distance, with the sun reflecting off the lake, I caught sight of the peninsula and the city of Erie, and then began to wonder, as I often did at new destinations whose location was defined by coastline or mountain, why the place we were about to see was not more famous. A protected harbor in the lee of the Presque Isle Peninsula was dotted with little white-sailed boats that moored at night at the small boat marinas along the water. Miles of flat, sandy beach along the far shore of Presque Isle were paralleled by a line of breakwaters out in the lake, constructed to moderate wave surges and erosion, and a matching line of lifeguard stations and snack shops along the shore. In the grid of the city itself, on the bluffs overlooking the lake, the houses visible through the thick, leafy tree cover had a classic pre-World War II small-town America look. To the far right of our view of the city, up the lakeshore toward Buffalo, was a huge industrial expanse, GE's main locomotive plant. To the far left, down the lake toward Cleveland, and running parallel to the shore, was the long runway of Erie's main airport, Tom Ridge Field, named for the local boy who had become a Republican governor of Pennsylvania and, after the 9/11 attacks, the first Secretary of Homeland Security. The winds were strong and from the west, so with guidance from the Erie control tower, I guided the plane over the GE plant and then came along the shore. Water to our right, close-in city and distant farmland to our left, runway ahead in the sunlight, the whole giving us a first impression of another American gem. The second impression came as we drove through the city, where the vista was less of beauty than of decay. Along West 12th Street, the main road from the airport through town, we passed one abandoned 100-year-old red brick factory after another. To the left, a former brass casting factory. To the right, a machine shop. In the historic downtown, vacant shop fronts outnumbered the occupied ones. In front of a tattered 1970s-era hotel, a crowd of mainly white homeless people congregated. On the highway out of town, toward Penn State's satellite Behrend campus, the largest industrial building in the area sat with a caved-in roof, sunlight streaming through the bare rafters, and presumably rain and snow during the long winters, too. These were all signs of the eerie that, as we came to know, would dominate election cycle coverage in this part of the country. The declining, mainly white, Rust Belt settlements, where the loss of jobs meant the rise of resentment and fuel for Donald Trump. In the 8 months after our visit, 4 months leading up to the election, and four afterward trying to explain its results, both TV and newspaper reports used Erie as a classic case of the modern dispossession that had led to Trump-era politics. A generation ago, the GE locomotive plant had had a unionized workforce of thousands, and Erie, its environs, and the entire state of Pennsylvania had been Democratic strongholds. Now, GE was shedding hundreds of jobs every year. The surrounding supply chain that fed it was withering, and while the city of Erie eked out a Democratic result in 2016, the county, the surrounding area, the state as a whole, and, of course, the nation through the Electoral College, had chosen Donald Trump. Those were two faces of Erie, two faces of America. Natural blessings, modern cruelty and challenge. But over several visits to Erie, we found other equally compelling threads of the story of Erie, matching much of what we had seen in our travels across America.
Erie's downtown is a shifting mosaic of old and new. The original stately and imposing former U.S. Bank of Pennsylvania building, constructed in 1839, sits around the corner from the beckoning modern glass entry and outdoor esplanade of the LEED-certified Erie Art Museum. These are two complementary wings of a single sprawling complex, which reaches all the way down to the depths of the old bank vault, whose abundant holdings range widely. There's a folk art collection of duck decoys, which the museum's founding director, John Vanko, a collector himself, showed me lined up and organized in the back room awaiting their debut center stage. There's an installation by local artist Lisa Lichtenfels depicting and memorializing the counter of a beloved Erie diner, the Avalon, where she had been a waitress. Across the street is Erie's still-bustling Army-Navy surplus store, and farther along to the south are trendy new restaurants and microbreweries, and the YMCA under renovation. And beyond that, the classic Renaissance Center building, whose worn 1920s vintage exterior belies the startup progressive energy within. To the north, and in season, the Farmers Market and Downtown Summer Jazz Festival spill over downhill past hospitals and medical facilities to the up-and-coming Harbor's Edge, with its new hotels, restaurants, a convention center, and kitschy pirate ships for tourists to ride. This is the heart of the nautical heritage of Erie. Greeting you at the Blasco Memorial Library, with its reading room overlooking the harbor, is an installation called Aquatic Dancers by local artist John Vahanian, which reminds me of sails floating over the broad staircase in the main atrium. Adjacent is the Erie Maritime Museum, recounting the region's lake-centric history from Oliver Hazard Perry onward, and the Bicentennial Tower. If you get to the top of the tower, you can see in all directions, from the old town and out beyond Presque Isle, and you can steep a little in the history of Commodore Perry and the lake battles of the War of 1812. Erie feels like a work in progress, but one that is clearly progressing. During our time there, we met two of Erie's elder visionaries who are putting their muscle and money behind plans for a vibrant, composed downtown for Erie. A few weeks before our visit, we learned that Joel Duderman, a successful entrepreneur who had built his company in a suburban office park outside Erie, had announced that he was moving his Velocity Network, a provider of high-speed internet services, into the middle of downtown. We looked at the vacant building proposed as the headquarters and across the street to others where Duderman thought he might invest in restaurants, cafes, and other common areas. These projects may provide not only the workspace, but also the shopping, dining, and eventually condo and apartment living that could keep workers nearby. When I was younger, I thought that business was a kill-or-be-killed proposition, remarked Duderman, who is now in his early 50s and has reached a reflective point in his life. I came to realize that if I did things with an awareness of the common good, the benefits would also come back to me, and with a heck of a lot less effort. Even more an Erie veteran and bulwark is the major financial building block of the region, Erie Insurance, the homegrown Fortune 500 company and largest Erie employer, which was founded by H.O. Hirt, an anti-World War I socialist, nearly a century ago, and remains under that ongoing family management through his son-in-law, Tom Hagen. Hagen's youthful vigor and informal, easy, generous manner is a model of what many people would hope to be in their 80s. He and his late wife, Susie, have been behind Erie in so many ways that recounting them would fill extra pages in this book. Once we learned of the Hagens, we saw their names seemingly everywhere in philanthropic leadership, from rooms in the art museum to the back wing of the Chautauqua Institution Amphitheater. One of Hagen's missions has been a commitment to redeveloping the city's downtown and business base, which he has done through investments of hundreds of millions of dollars in Erie insurance buildings in formerly troubled areas of downtown. Startups are moving into town as well. Radius Cowork, a high-tech shared workspace of the sort you would expect to find in Brooklyn or San Francisco, and that we had come to expect to find almost everywhere, moved into the Renaissance Center, just a few blocks from the solid Erie Insurance headquarters and Duderman's newly planned site. We took the creaky elevator to the ninth floor of the once Grand Dame building. It's the kind of elevator with a metal expandable inner door that takes all your effort and a careful eye on your fingers to operate. Inside the offices, you feel the permanence of the original and the promise of what might be. The big old office spaces have been chopped up, rearranged, and then shored up with sheetrock into smaller offices. The decor is make-do, but the activity, that's a different matter. There are designers, software engineers, creative types, business entrepreneurs, caterers, and video makers, many of them sporting remarkable tattoos, hair designs, and apparel. Just a few doors away from Radius are the offices of the Erie Reader, a successful print publication in the model of 7 days in Burlington. The Reader has been publishing since 2010. Its long-form reporting and opinions have made it a must-read among the progressive-minded population in Erie. The annual 40 Under 40 is an index of young business, cultural, and civic figures who have chosen to make something happen here. It is a competitive field, and the number of candidates for this recognition continues to grow.
These advances in Erie are fighting the currents of some serious traditional structural obstacles. Pennsylvania's school funding system is one of them. Compared with other states, it is uniquely unfair, in effect giving the cities with the least local resources, like downtown Erie, the smallest amount of state aid. The schools were nearly broke and had pinched every penny they could to stretch the budgets. On the hot summer day, we met with the then school superintendent, Jay Badams. He apologized for the lack of air conditioning, which they had turned off as a way of saving a little money. School was not yet in session, but even driving past the imposing Gothic campus of Collegiate Academy, formerly known as Academy High School, we saw immediate evidence of the lack of dollars for upkeep and maintenance that the system requires. It had gotten so bad that not long before our visit, Erie's school system had threatened simply to close its public high schools unless the funding inequities were resolved. a cruel twist of the knife. Pennsylvania requires districts to offer schooling only up to age 14. In practice, Erie would have paid to bus the students to the surrounding, much better funded suburban schools. After fighting for years to make the case for fairer school funding for Erie, while reorganizing and consolidating the school districts and also reducing spending, in early 2017, Badhams took a job as superintendent of a district that covers schools in Hanover, New Hampshire, and Norwich, Vermont. This is a town that is often hampered by its absolute refusal to move on from tradition, Badhams said of Erie in a departure interview with the Erie Times News. I'm proud of our school community for leading the way. The district is going to go through the process of reimagining itself and then seeing that to reality in a way that could be emulated by the rest of the city. In stark contrast to the challenges of the K-12 system in Erie is the explosion of its post-secondary opportunities. For starters, there are the nearby major colleges. Penn State's Behrend campus, with over 5,000 students, and a separate R&D center and engineering and business schools. Gannon University and Mercyhurst University, both Catholic institutions of about 4,000 students each. And the Lake Erie College of Osteopathic Medicine, LECOM, a private school of about 2,000 students for osteopathic medicine, pharmacy, and dentistry. This abundance of post-secondary opportunities has brought youthful drive and intellect to Erie, and with that, a natural spillover of optimistic attitude and culture. This new Rust Belt phenomenon of positivity and activity, similar to what you can find in Buffalo up the road or Youngstown and Cleveland down the road, is well underway, but is often drowned out as the more familiar older school, older generation refrains of despair and anger hang on. Dreary Erie, some folks say, the ones who still mourn the passing of GE. But as we have seen in places from West Virginia to Mississippi to the Central Valley of California, negative self-image can be a motivator as well as a handicap. We're nothing but optimistic about this place, one of the young entrepreneurs said. It's such a large canvas to paint on. And of their downcast parents' generation, it's time to move on. In Erie, we found another example of creating structural opportunity in answer to structural unfairness, like the one represented by the public education funding system. It was the counterpart to the Why Not Dodge campaign in Dodge City and the NIZ, Neighborhood Improvement Zone funding scheme for downtown redevelopment in Allentown. Erie's version is known as ECGRA. This stands for Erie County Gaming Revenue Authority, and it is usually pronounced as a word, EGRA. We met Perry Wood, a young family man who grew up not far from Erie in the town of Franklin, at the EGRA offices near the Penn State Behrend campus, on the eastern edge of town. EGRA, of which Wood is the director, was formed after Pennsylvania decided to authorize casinos and revive its horse racing industry in 2004. Erie's is the Presque Isle Downs and Casino, named for the beautiful Peninsular State Park, but located off the easily accessible interstate just south of town, it is a combined racetrack and casino. Virtually all lottery and casino schemes devote at least some of their money to schools or some other public benefit purpose. What is notable about Erie's, which has been open for about 8 years, is the unique, at least to the experience of what we have seen, way the community has decided to use its share of the casino revenues. The short version of a complex story is that 1% of the Presque Isle complex's total revenues comes back to Erie County. Half of that goes to retire bonds for airport expansion and other big infrastructure projects. The other half, totaling roughly $5 million per year, goes through EGRA for use towards the general goal of regional economic development. This share was about $1 million a year higher until neighboring Ohio opened casinos recently and drew off some of Presque Isle's traffic. Erie has matched a familiar source of money, gambling, with a widespread civic goal, economic and technical renewal, in a novel and apparently successful way. Perry Wood told us, "The structure of our Gaming Revenue Commission is unique in having the flexibility to use the money for economic development. We're asking ourselves, what can we do to shape the future of this community? What can we do to make it more attractive to young people? What will make Erie a more vital community?" EGRA has done plenty. It supports a program called Go College, a college initiative project that helps Erie students through tutoring and college search assistance. Ignite Erie is an across-the-board tech startup initiative designed to connect universities, technical colleges, entrepreneurs, and financiers to foster new businesses in the inner-city areas. Tech After Hours allows displaced workers, adults, and others to use school system facilities after the regular school day for training as welders, machinists, builders, and other high-wage skilled trades. A youth summer jobs program in 1 year hired 170 people from ages 16 through 19 in construction and landscaping jobs that give them both an income and some soft skills training, Wood said. After a while in Erie, we began to recognize the role that terms like vital and future and attracting young people play in the discourse by Wood and his 30-something local contemporaries. At first glance, Erie seems to illustrate just the opposite. The population has long been shrinking. Many of the factories look shuttered and closed. The historic downtown is in an obvious pre- rather than post-rebirth stage. And compared with the rest of the country and even the state, the people are, on average, old and poor. That's why it was so impressive to find a group of next-generation Erieites, those who never expected to get a lifetime job at the giant GE locomotive plant and therefore aren't devastated as GE keeps shifting those jobs to Texas. Those who look at the inexpensive real estate and still present manufacturing infrastructure and see possibilities opening rather than closing. These are the people who think they can make this the next hot, successful city. The point that comes back to us is the starkness of the contrast. On the one hand, the flattened terms, angry, resentful, hopeless, the language the media and politicians use to describe America in general. And on the other hand, the engaged, changing realities people understand about the places where they actually live. The point may sound banal, but it has consequences. In the very same terrain that was just described as Rust Belt loser land in a big presidential campaign rally, and whose urban landscape clearly shows the structural and human marks of traumatic change, people are trying to anticipate and adapt to those changes, to improve their individual and collective futures, and generally to behave as if they are actors in their own dramas, rather than just being acted upon. Being active rather than passive is one working definition of today's American idea.
Erie finds a hypercharged boost of optimism and energy from another sizable portion of its population, refugees and immigrants. Erie has a long history of immigrants and refugees. It goes back to the early 20th century, with an influx of Poles, Italians, Germans, Irish, and Russians. Now the faces have changed to include Africans, Asians, and Middle Easterners. Some 10% of today's Erie residents arrived as refugees. Those who make it to Erie are probably the most likely of the city's residents to want to be part of Erie's success and do whatever it takes to get there. After what they've been through, how could they not be part of this optimism? I went to visit the starting point for Erie's continuing flow of new arrivals, the field office of the U.S. Committee for Refugees and Immigrants. It was already beginning to bustle before 9 a.m. on a hot August morning. A woman wearing a bright African cloth wrapped at the waist, with two little children beside her, was sitting on the concrete step in front of the building, waiting for something or someone. Clusters of others, mostly talking quietly in Arabic, were waiting inside in the stuffy reception area. A few of the staffers behind the reception windows were greeting everyone who came in. Along the narrow halls, there were daycare rooms and there was a play area outside. Beyond some of the parked strollers and water dispensers, a language lesson was in progress. The instructor was juggling a meld of English grammar and culture for a dozen or more men and women seated at long tables. Behind closed doors in smaller offices, staff members were helping people with resettlement procedures. The to-do list is long. Housing, employment, language help, schools, childcare, transportation, health screening, doctors, dentists, clothing, cash assistance, social security cards, and the steps to citizenship. Other topics are looser. Neighborhoods, shopping, parks, the library, emergencies, calendars, deadlines, and cultural guidelines, like when it's appropriate to dial 911, and expectations for work or school attendance. As the morning wore on, people continued to drift in. The building was filling up. Upstairs in her office was Delana Jackson, who directs the program and has been working around the United States with refugees and immigrants for about two decades. She moves purposefully and quickly, every brown hair in place, addressing questions with the confidence of her experience. Jackson described the reasons for the current whirlwind. She called it the summer bulge. Summer is traditionally a busy time for refugee resettlement, but in 2016 it was even more so, since the Obama administration had raised its annual goal of Syrian refugee admissions almost sixfold to 10,000 people. All the agencies are working as fast as they can, said Jackson, noting that more people had been moved more quickly into the pipeline. In Pennsylvania's Region 5, home to Erie, the arrivals numbered in the 30s and 40s from November through March, fell to 15 in April, then shot up to 79 in June and 91 in July. That summer, the total since October 2015 for Region 5 was 520, and it was 2,645 for all of Pennsylvania. Part of that summer bulge was the Zakrit family, who arrived in Erie early in June. In 2012, Mohammed Zakrit was living in Aleppo, Syria, with his young wife Yasmin and their two small daughters, and was working in a fabric factory. Then one day, his neighborhood was bombed by the forces of Bashar al-Assad. His house was destroyed and he was injured. He showed us a video on his phone of the devastation, confusion, and injuries. Zakrit and his family fled Syria for a camp in Lebanon. After a few months, the family moved on to Jordan. He had lost track of his brother in Aleppo, and to this day he doesn't know his fate. Seeing no future in Jordan, the family applied to the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees to obtain refugee status. After 3 years in Jordan, they were offered the chance to resettle in the United States. Zakrit, 36, and his wife, 26, and their growing family of four young children boarded a plane in Amman, bound for Chicago and ultimately Erie. I went to visit the Zakrit family in their modest house on the east side of Erie, a few blocks east of State Street, which is the socioeconomic dividing line in Erie. The fancier folks live on the west side. Arriving at the doorstep of their new home is often the hardest moment for refugees, Jackson had told me, especially for those who were doctors, lawyers, or other professionals in their previous lives. They were suddenly walking through the door into their new reality and a much more humble life, which would be at least temporarily permanent. When Mohammed pulled up to the curb in his family's new used minivan, I was, I admit, a little surprised. "Bought on time," the translator Bassam Daba explained. "Of course." The family lived on the first floor of the house, which they rent for about $600 a month. For three bedrooms and one bath, it seemed like a bargain until I did the math, figuring that at a starter job, once he gets one, Zakrit will probably earn somewhere between the minimum wage of $7.25 an hour and $10 an hour. There was plenty of furniture around the house, all obviously secondhand, and a nice TV. The two older girls shared a room with each other and their favorite girly toys, which they told me are Barbies. Anayat, who is 8 years old, said she wants to be a doctor. Hanin, who is 6, wants to be an airplane pilot. School would start very soon, and they would be able to walk the few blocks from their house. 1.5-year-old Yahya, the Zakrit's only son, who toddled around the apartment sturdily, and tiny Rimas, just 6 months old, were both remarkably good and patient through my visit, I thought, especially for little ones, without much diversion. In Erie, as in Sioux Falls and Burlington, we repeatedly heard the range of work histories from refugees, from those who'd left behind menial jobs or no jobs at all, to those who'd had to abandon professional jobs, as lawyers, administrators, doctors, and teachers. They all arrive in the United States as equals and are all now scrambling to patch together whatever they can. Mohammed Zakrit says he will take any job he can get. He hopes to be happy in Erie and make his home there. "We are treated as human beings," he told me through his translator. "America is a dream country." How would the Zakrit family, like others, make it a few years down the road? In Erie, the longer-term support system is a mosaic of organizations. Churches, schools, YMCAs, cultural centers, public libraries, community centers, food banks, businesses, transport systems, medical services, and on and on. I went to visit one of these support groups, the Multicultural Community Resource Center, MCRC, which occupies the old Penn Schoolhouse and has an annex next door at the former 10th Street United Methodist Church. The MCRC began as the Hispanic American Council in 1975, broadening its scope nearly 20 years ago to include newer faces from Somalia, Congo, Bhutan, Iraq, Syria, and many other countries. The group's mission, which is funded by as many as 24 organizations from government and civic groups, to corporations, nonprofits, and private benefactors, is to help refugees and immigrants settle into Erie long-term in just about every way. On the day I visited, the buildings were humming. I knew by now to expect such high-energy buzz and constant motion, which I had witnessed at refugee centers around the country. The MCRC runs at least 15 different programs, including those addressing transportation, healthcare navigation, notary public services, and language translation in Spanish, Bosnian, Russian, Ukrainian, Arabic, Vietnamese, Swahili, and Burmese. They touch a lot of cultural bases most of us wouldn't even think of, like truancy prevention and referrals for children at risk of being placed out of their homes. The center's employment services arm, called Mosaico, is a for-profit subsidiary of the nonprofit MCRC. It matches employers and employees, and it supports both sides with language and cultural help. Many lines of work available are just what you'd expect: food services, construction, general labor, and the like. We visited the factory of one of the employers, Plastec, an internationally successful manufacturer of plastics packaging that makes many commonly used containers, for example, deodorant holders and detergent bottles. Workers I watched on the line could well have made some of the bottles or packages that Jim and I use every single day. Time and again, we breached these few degrees of separation between us and America's refugees and immigrants around the country in such factories and plants. Today it was our plastic bottles in Erie. Weeks ago it was our steaks in Dodge City. Paul Jericho, the Associate Director for Programs at MCRC, toured me around the center. Jericho told me that refugees fit in well with a growing entrepreneurial